Coming to you from the city where it is illegal to have a puppet show in your window. What? Well, there goes my final project. It's Ventriloquism Weekly. Thank you guys for making hashtag Ask Strassman a huge success. Matt Bailey here, so excited to bring you our interview with the incredibly inventive David Strassman. And I say ours because it includes your questions. This is a great way to kick off April. Known for the obnoxious Chuck Wood and lovably innocent Ted E. Bear, Strassman gained popularity for his ventriloquism shows that feel more like plays than traditional vent figure routines. Ventriloquists love him for what he has deemed puppetronics, a fantastic use of servos in his characters that you'll get to hear about in just a few moments. Here now to fill us in on everything from his desire to be an astronaut to why exactly his largest following is overseas, and the answer will surprise you, it surprised me, our interview with David Strassman. David Strassman, welcome to Ventriloquism Weekly. How are you today, sir?
Hey, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. I want to dive right in. How did you get started in ventriloquism?
Well, first of all, I'm not moving my lips right now, and I'm actually having you ask me the questions.
Oh, that's great. I love it.
How I got interested, it's a short but long story, and I was studying magic when I was 11, 12 years old. And in year 7, a teacher decided to offer an elective course in ventriloquism.
Really?
And I had a choice of taking, math, French, or ventriloquism. And of course, I took the easy A. But since it was, you know, considered the same art as magic, I thought ventriloquism would be cool. And only 6 or 7 kids signed up, and I was excelled the class, but what the teacher did, his name is Stephen Hart, you can probably find him on Facebook, he ran a children's TV show in Chicago where I was living at the time, and was the one that taught this class.
He taught me
how to advertise in a local paper to do kids' shows, and so when the money started coming in, my interest really picked up.
That's awesome. So those first shows, he helped you get them?
Oh, I advertised in a local paper.
Yeah.
And I did 20 minutes of magic and 10 minutes of intro.
So
I did birthday parties.
That's awesome. So how did your style evolve as you grew up and decided you wanted to do this?
Oh, I never wanted to do it. Ventriloquism was never what I wanted to do. I wanted to be an astronaut, having grown up in the age of Apollo and Gemini. I was 12 years old when they landed on the moon, and that's really what I wanted to do. And showbiz was just a side thing. You know, all my friends, they'd be cutting the grass for $5 for 5 hours, and I'd be doing a magic show for $30 for a half hour. So I kind of fell into it because it was easy and fun. In high school, I started theater, and I was involved in a lot of plays and musicals and choir. Really, really enjoyed being an artist and entertainer, and I decided I want to go to acting school and pursue legitimate theater.
Yes.
And I was going to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts in New York City, and it was then, after a year of that, I decided to, well, my dad said, why don't you pull Chuck out? I was doing ventriloquism on the side. He said, why don't you pull Chuck out in Central Park and see if you can make some money?
Hmm.
And I said, no, that's stupid. I don't want to do that. And at the time, this is 1977, there were only about 8 street performers in the entire New York City. It really was not a major thing that you see now. And so I went to Central Park. I pulled Chuck out. I did my first show and made like $15. I went, oh, my God, that was amazing for 10 minutes work.
Yeah,
and
awesome.
That summer and fall, I started working full-time as a street performer in New York. I would do Wall Street at noon. I would do 7 p.m. to 7:45 on Broadway for the theater crowds. I would work Central Park on the weekends during the Saturday and Sunday days. On Friday and Saturday nights, I'd work Baker Street in the Village from like 10 o'clock to 3 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I was making probably $500 a week in nickels, dimes, and quarters.
That's incredible. So when did you make the decision? Was it just because it was good money and it was coming in on that sort of disproportionate basis to other people who were your age? When did you decide, okay, I'm not going to go for the astronaut, I'm going to do this, and this is what I'm going to make of my life?
Well, I think the astronaut thing went away when I kind of got the theater bug in high school. So
yeah.
And then I grew up in the early 70s, so they probably did a drug test. I wouldn't make the astronaut corps anyway. So what happened was I was performing on the streets and realized that I really had to get a good routine going because, A, you have to project and you have to be heard over the din of the traffic surrounding streets. You have to get people's attention so they'll stop and form a crowd. And then you have to do a finale, a bit where they clap and laugh and then want to give you money at the end. So I structured a routine that did that. And then it got cold. And I went, oh, gee, I can't perform anymore. And Someone said, well, hey, you ought to try one of the comedy clubs. At the time, in 1977, there was Catch a Rising Star, the Improv, and the Comic Strip. Mm-hmm. Those were the three major clubs in New York City at the time. And so I went to the Catch a Rising Star. It was my first audition. And I went there at 6 in the afternoon, the evening, and didn't get on until 3 in the morning in front of four drunk people who couldn't care if I was funny or not. And it really, oh, what a horrible experience that was. And then I went to the comic strip and started getting spots there, you know, late in the morning. You know, on the weekend, I'd be on at 3 and 4 in the morning. Wow. During the week, you'd be lucky to get an 11 or 12 o'clock spot. And, you know, all the guys that were getting the good spots were like Jerry Seinfeld and Larry Miller and those types of guys. And I started working the comedy club circuit, and I did pretty much the comic strip and the improv for the next 2 years, and that led to some satellite gigs in Jersey and the Bronx and the Queens and Brooklyn, and then my first out-of-town gig was the comedy gig in Washington, D.C. I can't remember what that was called. And then there was one in Philly, a club in Philly, and then the comic strip in Florida. And that took me to about 1979, and I started as an opening act making some pretty good money. I was making $50 a show, roughly.
It's awesome. I think, and it's interesting hearing about how it was in the 70s, because everything nowadays is bringers. You don't get put on a showcase. You have to bring the audience. So it's very interesting how that has changed.
Yeah. Well, unless you have a name, that's a different story.
Right. Now, I want to keep moving here, because there's a lot of good stuff. You're very, very original, and I'm sure you've been told that a million times over. I was told that if you gave yourself a handle, if you created a show versus just having an act, that it's easier to play certain types of venues, and you have a show. Everything is a show. There's a through line. There's a story. Can you speak to the difference in having a show, having a theatrical event versus just having an act with your character?
Well, it really was a function of the trajectory of my career. Starting in 80, I started doing the comedy club circuit, and that was when it exploded in America. By 1982, I was an opening act, almost starting to become a middle act, and there were clubs in almost every city in every major city in the United States, at least by the late 80s, there certainly was. And I worked my way up from opening to middle to headliner. And right when I started getting headlining gigs, I got really bored of what I was doing, because it was just me and Chuck. It was a bunch of stupid jokes. There was no innovation. I really couldn't see where this was going, and I took a year off in 1985 to produce a comedy club in Bakersfield, California, to actually not be on stage. Well, I kind of emceed, but I was more in the production side of it. Which, by the way, I had, in order to get my own gigs, and when I first moved to California in 1979, I created comedy nights at UCLA, USC, Northridge University and Loyola University.
Wow.
I created comedy nights there where I booked the entertainers. I got all the comics from the Comedy Store. I hired guys like Michael Keaton and Jim Carrey. I mean, the list goes on and on.
It's incredible.
Everybody got paid $50. So I hired Michael Keaton for $50.
Oh,
and
wow.
All these comedians, I asked them, hey, can you get me into the Sacramento gig? Can you get me into the Seattle gig? And all these guys, to return the favor, got me in the door with a lot of the comedy clubs. So when I took this year off, I really was kind of in a state of flux. I did a little bit of Chuck. And that's when, for the end of the year, I was with a buddy of mine in San Francisco. And one drunken night, we said, wouldn't it be cool if we can put radio control servos in Chuck? And I've always and still do fly model airplanes. One of my hobbies. I fly scale aircraft, pretty big ones too. I'm also a pilot. I fly the real thing. But I've always flown model airplanes, and he was a fellow model aviation enthusiast. So we started figuring out how I started building a second Chuck with servos in him. And the whole idea was that he would fire me, and then I would leave the stage, and he would come to life. But we couldn't figure out the clutch, and that was, how do you move the mouth with my hand on the stick and my thumb on a string, but not have that break the mechanical electric servo that moves it when I'm not operating him? And so a buddy of mine worked at JPL, actually it was NASA research facility in Berkeley, California, and he says, well, I've got an idea for a clutch. And we snuck into NASA at 3 a.m, past the Einsteinian blackboards with all the planetary mechanic calculations on them. And he machined this little clutch for me. And I took Chuck and remade him. I completely made him myself. I did all the fiberglassing and painting. And I installed all the very cool robotics. Took a radio control airplane transmitter, opened it up, pulled out the circuit board, wrapped it in gaffer tape, extended the potentiometers, you know, the joysticks to a little thing. I hold it by hand, a little ribbon cable down my sleeve. And for the first time, I did it in New York City at a comedy club called The Cellar. I'm pretty sure it's still there.
Mm-hmm.
I walked on stage, did my show, and then at the end, I had a fight with Chuck. And he fired me, and I left the stage and went under the side where there was a secondary mic. And after a pregnant pause, I moved his eyes left, I moved his eyes right, and then said, is he gone? And the audience got over. This is probably 87, 86. This is before How They Make Walking with Dinosaurs. This is before all the people really knew about robotics or special effects. And this audience, big gas, and they were looking for the exit. You know, oh my God, a puppet had come alive.
Wow.
And it really was, at that moment I went, wow, not only do I have an amazing new place in this art form, but I've added the element of theater. So I added a little music and I had the lights in. And I realized, wow, I am on start of something really, really different.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool. That, yeah, and it's just kind of, it's just blossomed from there. I gotta ask, off of that, for Teddy Bear, with all the different versions and variations, how many of him do you have? How many Chucks do you have? And Steve Axtell wants to know who makes your characters because of how complex they end up being.
Now, Chuck was a mail-order puppet from Wisconsin. I can't remember the name of the guy. His puppet was called Little Stevie. It was the smaller of all the puppets that I could afford. It was $90, including postage. This is back in 1973, I think, when I mail ordered them.
Mm-hmm.
The next chuck I built by myself, I made a mold of this chuck. I made some slight alterations to the face and then poured fiberglass, laid up fiberglass. So I've made the chucks that I've had. I think I'm on version 4 or 5. There's been also a Real Boy chuck made by Jim Henson, which was a chuck in one show that I had that comes to life and stands up and turns into a real boy.
Oh, my gosh.
Then there were some foam latex chuck faces, which we cut up with a chainsaw for something I did a long time ago. The most latest chuck I've made is a new chuck without hair and a Maori tattoo on his head.
Yes.
And I've built all the heads and painted the faces for all the chucks. Teddy Bear is a hand-sewn cloth puppet. I had this wonderful woman in L.A. who retired, geez, at least a decade ago, and I pretty much had seamstresses make teddy bears. There's only about 2 right now. I think I retired one last year and sold it for auction to a charity.
Very cool.
Kevin is designed back in the late 90s. He's the alien character. He's a puppet that I wanted to have no seams where the body joins the arm.
Yeah, that's really cool.
The body.
That's a really cool illusion.
And he's part fiberglass and foam latex. And for Kevin, I have professional sculptors. I first had a guy draw up a design, which gets approved, and the design becomes a clay mold, and then the clay mold becomes fiberglass molds or silicone molds, and then you make pores out of that and molds out of that, and then poly foam and latex for Kevin. Let's see here. Sid the Beaver was an idea a guy had, which I said, hey, I'm a beaver. He eats wood. I'm going to ask you. But then 4 or 5 years later, I was really drunk in a Cincinnati nightclub, and I said, hey, how about I put the beaver on my show? So he came in the show. Grandpa Fred was kind of a natural extension of Teddy Bear as his relative. You know, and it's funny, everybody kind of has a grandpa character.
Yes.
Dan Horn being the first one I ever saw.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jeff Dunham has the, what's his name?
Walter.
What?
Walter.
Walter, yeah. Yeah, who is just fantastic with the crossed arms.
Yes.
And so I think my grandpa character is more of a forgetful Alzheimer's than a lecherous or an angry. Walter's kind of angry. Orson was great. You know, yeah. Jeff Dan Horn with the he had the arms working on the stick.
Yes. Yes, Dan is fantastic manipulator.
Yeah, so Grandpa Fred was kind of an extension of Teddy Bear. And then my last show was really weird, Careful What You Wish For, which I think it's on Netflix now.
Yes.
I traveled down to another dimension where there are strange doubles of all the characters that are different in a different dimension. So there are kind of doubles of each character. And so some of those characters won't exist. Oh, Angel. Angel's my first female character in my show. She's an android cyborg.
Yeah.
It's pretty twisted.
I'm going to actually stop you down the list there because one of the questions we got, I did a hashtag event since we've arranged this a couple days before, hashtag Ask Strassman. I wanted people to send in their questions. And I got a question for you that I even had myself. Angel's voice, okay? I love her. But the question I have, the thing that boggles my mind, and if you don't want to reveal this, this is fine. The quickness with which the robotic sound goes away so that you can talk.
One thing my show has really a lot of high tech, and you know, Chuck's arm has 7 servos in each arm, so he has the full range of motion that a human arm has. Angel is pretty simple. There is an incredible voice machine called VoiceLive, and it's when you sing into it, it will actually add 3 or 4 harmony voices. You can set the keys, the timbre. You can set, whether it's dissonance or a third harmony. It also has, Arnold Schwarzenegger deep set voice, the devil voices, and very high voices. It has like 100 presets, and so I messed around with it and got a voice that was feminine yet robotic. And the voice is me doing Chuck's voice. So basically, I don't have to kind of change the character's voice for Angel. However, Angel does have a different type of loop, and she has a different pacing. So
yeah.
If you were to hear Chuck's voice doing Angel, it would sound like Chuck, but it wouldn't.
Right. Yeah.
I have a transmitter inside Angel that I turn on whenever I have her speak. It's a button I press whenever she speaks, and I release the button whenever I don't want her to have that voice.
That's awesome.
That transmitter transmits a relay to the voice box. This voice live at the sound desk, which automatically turns on the affected voice. And there's a lag. There's a half-second lag between when the voice comes on, particularly. So the real trick in doing Angel was figuring out how to turn her on a half-second before she actually has to say something.
So even you have to figure out how to do something even though she's not talking, and it's kind of a little choreographed in that sense, I would assume.
Well, it's timing, really. Timing. Yeah. I had to actually push the button a half second before I ever wanted her to speak, and sometimes that was as I'm just ending a word in my voice. But the great thing about Angel is her voice is not human, and it is definitely live. There's nothing recorded about it.
Oh, no, cool. No, absolutely. And that's, I was not getting at that. I was getting at how you are able to switch between the use of technology and sort of back to normal basics of theater so quickly and in the moment. Because I think one of the main arguments, and I want against sort of, and trust me, I'm on team, let's use technology, invent, and let's throw the robotics in there and see what we can do. The argument is, somebody can go, oh, where are the batteries? Where's that voice coming from if it's not you?
Who cares?
And it's, exactly. And,
I used to do a joke in my show, or a trick in my show. And I kind of, on hindsight, I'm kind of disappointed that I gave it away to the audience, but I just couldn't really kind of do this trick and keep it as though it's not a lie. And what I would do is I would stop the show, and ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to attempt to throw my voice to take the Guinness Book of World Record for throwing voice across the stage. I made the stupid thing. Edgar Bergen did it in Caesar's Palace in 1971, and he threw his voice measured at 4.2 meters. And today, on this stage, I'm going to throw it to the back of the room, measured at 15 meters, three times the distance. We have a representative from the Guinness Book of World Records, Mr. Bob Smith, up in the thing. Hello, Bob. He's going, hey, Dave. And I made it sound like I was about to break a record. And what we did was we had speakers in the back of the audience. And even on the theaters that had 2 or 3 levels, we had to set up speakers at every level that there were people sitting. And I would turn off my mic and just talk normally in the audience. I said, can you see that my mic is now off? There is no amplification. I'm speaking to you. And it's quite a different sound when you're in a theater and you've been hearing an artist talking through a mic. And then when it turns off, it really is pretty obvious you're not on any amplification system. But I'd say, here I go. I'm now going to throw my voice. Here we go. And I'd make it really quiet. The audience is all thinking that they're going to be part of this incredible witness of a Guinness Book of World Record event. And I say, can you hear me now? And they all go, yeah, we hear you. And then I'd say, I'd make my face as though like I'm going to the bathroom, like, right?
Right.
And then you'd hear from the back of the room, can you hear me back here? And because the audience heard it behind them, they erupted in cheers, and they stood to their feet, and it was like they witnessed the most amazing, amazing throwing of your voice demonstration. And then I had Chuck up through the speaker and make it sound like a tape's going, like a tape's all screwing up and going fast and back.
Yeah.
And so then the audience knew I was playing a joke on them. But in hindsight, I should have just made it seem like I was the greatest ventriloquist on the planet. But I don't know. I couldn't lie to my audience. I just couldn't do it.
No, and I think you hit on something, which is you can play with technology, and it's just important to drive home that it's you. So I like it, and I think it's that's very, very clever. It's very well.
Here's
done.
Here's what I try to do with my show. I love theater. I love when you're sitting in a theater and the lights go down, the curtain opens, and you see this amazing set, and there's a soundtrack of crickets, and the back psych wall looks like a late afternoon in the Midwest, and there's a tree, and it's all scenery.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes you to a place and a feeling, and that's what I love about theater. That's what I've always tried to do with my show. I've always wanted to put music as background during. There are many bits in many of my shows where a puppet will say something that's very heartfelt, and there'll be a music in the background, you know, and that's the kind of thing that I love to see when I'm sitting in the audience, the type of thing that I like to do in my show. And when I started playing theaters, going on national tours in Australia and England Australia was in the early 90s and then England in after 96, I realized that, well, here I have this massive theater and stage and fly lines, and that means I can have set and backdrops and borders and legs and curtains and special effects and music and lighting. And having started in theater, and I've done everything from being an actor on stage in musicals and plays to being stage crew. I've done lights and sound and built set, and I've done everything. I use my knowledge of theater to add that to my shows, and I just love it. I love seeing really big productions that are fun to watch, not productions that are cheap.
Absolutely, and it makes
For example, I took my son to see, it was How the Grinch Stole Christmas in the big theater in L.A., and it was so cheesy, and it had a big-name actor as the star, and the sets were cheesy, and I just was like, oh, my God, this is, what, $100 for this ticket? So, you know, I love theater, especially when it's simple. But, you know, all you need is, you know, you can have an empty stage and a back wall and throw some lights on it and make it appear like it's sunrise. You can make it appear like it's a warm afternoon somewhere.
Absolutely.
I love the magic of theater.
I love that. Yeah. And that's why I was excited to talk to you, is because you've really, really inserted it well. And it's taken off in these foreign countries for you. How did that come about? I mean, people are clamoring for you to tour here in the States. That's one of the, we had our friend Steven on the hashtag Ask Strassman. He asked if, he asked about any potential U.S. tours and how you got to be so big overseas.
Well, in 91, I was invited to Australia in a comedy club situation, and it went so well, we extended it another, we doubled the length of the engagement, and I ended up on every television show in Australia you can imagine, and that led me to New Zealand, and then that led me to the Edinburgh Festival in 96, where I pretty much showcased Chuck coming to live on stage, and also my three dinosaurs, which are robotic and sing Bohemian Rhapsody.
I love it.
And when I did that in Edinburgh, I won all these awards. No one had ever seen ventriloquism on such a theatrical level, even though it was just the beginnings of my big theater shows. And I really did well in England, Australia, Scotland, Ireland, pretty much the British Commonwealth. I had three television shows, one in England, one in Australia, one in New Zealand, which kind of cemented my notoriety and fame and the ability to do major national tours. And so I would be gone for three non-consecutive months a year and then come home and be a dad. And I really enjoyed not being famous here in L.A. and then going to Australia and getting a month of notoriety and then coming home and nobody knew me. And it was fantastic not having the invasive world of being a celebrity in your own home. So I pretty much didn't pursue anything here in the United States. And that's kind of where I've been. However, there are some irons in the fire, and I don't really want to talk about them because they don't exist yet. But if they do, you may see a bit more of me here in the United States.
That's great. Now, one iron in the fire that we want to talk about, because for hashtag Ask Strassman, this was the most asked question, which was, how did you get the Netflix thing up and running with Careful What You Wish For, and when can we see more of your specials and more Strassman on Netflix?
Well, my DVD distributor, I have five shows that I've filmed. Four or five, I can't remember. And then there's also a family, fantastic Australian outback adventure that I filmed in the wild of Australia with Chuck and Teddy and two boys on a journey. Pretty cool. But all my titles are available online in Australia, some in New Zealand, and because I have very little notoriety in the United States, and a little better in the UK, they are slowly making their way to, pretty much the Western world of availability of online download, online viewing. So Careful What You Wish For appeared just like a week ago without any cover art. I'm kind of bummed out about that, but we're working on that. So I'm guessing this is the year all my titles will end up in iTunes and Netflix and Hulu.
We can only hope. We can only hope. Now, last question. I love to ask.
But wait, my first three titles, the entire DVDs are on my YouTube. They're all broken down into scenes. So if you want to see my first three, they're in consecutive order on my YouTube channel.
I recommend you do that. Cause
and you can see that for free. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Go check it out because it's just awesome. But I don't think there's a ventriloquist on the planet who's not familiar with you. You do have a fan base here in America consisting of ventriloquists. We love your work, and so that's why I'm so excited to ask you my patented last question, which is, what do you want to see from the people who want to become ventriloquists today, coming up in this art form?
Well, I would love to see more theatrical shows. Back in the 19th century, ventriloquists had massive stage shows with many puppets. I kind of do that. And I would love to see more theater and more twisted stuff. Nina Conti does some really weird stuff.
Love Nina.
Told me about one thing she did. It never got filmed, but she once laid in a gynecologist's syrup and gave birth to a baby infant puppet. They actually gave birth to it and did a routine like that. So, that kind of weird, twisted, out-of-the-way stuff is fantastic. I'd love to see more technology and more innovation. But one thing I love to do is when I try to do my material, it's not why did the chicken cross the road? Oh, to get to the other side. It's okay, what trouble did you get into today? it's really not a joke. It's more like the character drives the humor rather than the humor driving the character.
That's a wonderful way to put it. Yeah, I believe we certainly need more of that. We need more of thinkers like David Strassman. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
David, thank you so much. I have a feeling we barely scratched the surface. I can't wait to have you back in the future. It was such an honor. You can find David on all of social media. Find him on Facebook and Twitter. Plus, Ted Ebert and Chuck Wood have their own Twitter accounts, and you can interact with all of them directly. Just look them up. That's it for us this week. A reminder, you can find all you need to know about Ventriloquism Weekly by going to our website, ventriloquismweekly.com. Reach out by emailing ventriloquismweekly@gmail.com and find our group on Facebook by searching Ventriloquism Weekly podcast for ventriloquists. And again, I know we still have that group. We also have facebook.com/talkfortwo, which is our like page. Go ahead, click like on Ventriloquism Weekly. And you can follow us or tweet about us using @ or hashtag, I always get those two mixed up, @ or hashtag talkfortwo, TalkFortwo, talkfortwo. Signing off for Ventriloquism Weekly from New York, I'm Matt Bailey, reminding all you vents out there to keep talking for two.